we did the RAG example, and I really messed up the picture of the pole that we did. And you draw a little control for you, and then you do this. I vaguely understand. I'm not gonna make my notes a lot.
You have to give the accessory permission to be able to click through. That's why it didn't work. Well, good morning. Thanks for making it in. I actually like this weather. It's good exercise. So, right. Any questions before we launch? As a reminder, always feel free to interrupt me, talk. It's more interesting when it's interactive. There is plenty I can simply tell you, and I will proceed to do that unless I am interrupted. So don't hesitate to interrupt me. Right. So we had just gotten to discussing that there were lots and lots of dark matter candidates, and people are making them up all the time at a prodigious rate. But the really well-motivated candidate was the weakly interacting massive particle. That came out of supersymmetry and the attempt to achieve some grand unified theories. Plus, it was motivated by that Wimp miracle we discussed last time, that the relic abundance of particles that interact weakly, if they're massive enough, frees out at about the right scale, the right time in the early universe to be the dark matter today. Those have not been found. Arguably, we should have found them by now. People have been looking very hard, and so the people who told us it had to be WIMPs, and we really believed it had to be WIMPs in the 80s and 90s and for a long time after, they'll say, oh, well, it could have been anything. We have all these candidates. And that's really a bit of gaslighting, because they were very sure it was going to be a WIMP. And that's why there are so many WIMP experiments. Vast majority of the deep underground big detection experiments are looking for those WIMPs. The other thing is that you can find them because they do interact weakly, so you can devise an experiment that defines them. You can imagine a particle that doesn't interact at all except through gravity. I call that the angel particle, because you could have an infinite number dancing on the head of the pin. You wouldn't know it because you can't detect it. But there are other things. Axions are the next most obvious things after WIMPs, perhaps. This was actually hypothesized for a real problem in charge parity symmetry in particle physics. But the axions that do that don't necessarily have anything to do with the dark matter problem. They might not. And people are starting to build more experiments to detect those. But then there's this whole zoo, and I've just given a few of the names that you might hear. Light dark matter. A terrible name, isn't it? We'll meet some really terrible names, and that's not even the worst one. What they mean is lightweight. And the reason for that is that there is a pretty strong theoretical limit called the Lee-Weinberg limit that says a WIMP-like particle has to have a mass of at least 2 GeV. Remember, a proton and a neutron is about 1 GeV. And the hypothesis, the original hypothesis for the WIMP would be that these were particles of around 100 GeV, so by themselves the mass of a biggish atomic nucleus. But that's not written in stone anywhere. That was just the first best guess. And so at some point, people figured out ways around this limit, and so they call that light dark matter, things that are lightweight because they violate that 2 GeV limit. On the other end, you can have things that are very big. There's really no limit until the unitarity limit at TeV scales. And those are sometimes called WIMPzillas, because they're like WIMPs, but very big. There are all sorts of things you can make up. Some more astronomically motivated things. These are mostly particle physics motivations. From an astronomical point of view, people have talked about warm dark matter and self-interacting dark matter. Warm is the Goldilocks temperature. It's not cold, and it's not hot. The temperature is just right. And that typically means a mass of a few keV, and that is not so hot that it prevents structure from forming, but it's not so cold that it forms structure right the way down to tiny, tiny things. Traditional WIMPs will make dark matter halos that are big, that are intermediate, that are small, all the way down to Earth mass. It's very cold, a little Earth mass, dark matter halos floating around. And warm dark matter does something intermediate. So it basically, it's like hot dark matter, but not as extreme. So it truncates the mass spectrum at some low mass scale that depends on what the mass actually is. And there are some reasons to that might be desirable astronomically. Self-interacting dark matter was first hypothesized to explain the microwave background observations from COBE. That didn't work. That was early 90s. Fell out of favor, and then it was reinvented in circa 2000 to explain the cusp core problem, which we'll learn about. But basically, cold dark matter predicts halos that are very dense. They just get denser and denser and denser as you go towards the center of that dark matter halo. Astronomical data say no, that's not what happens. It's a more flattened dark matter distribution. And so how do you achieve that? It's very hard to prevent cold dark matter from doing that. So warm dark matter is one way. Self-interacting dark matter is another way that the dark matter actually interacts and scatters off itself, and that redistributes that cusp into a core, maybe. Now, in order to achieve this, there has to be a mechanism by which the dark matter interacts. Now, the whole point of dark matter is that it doesn't interact electromagnetically. Right? That's how we interact. Everything pretty much we do is conveyed at some level by the electromagnetic force, and WIMPs don't do that. The weak force is much too weak to do anything that these are invoked to do. So as long as we're inventing a new form of particle, why not invent a new force as well? So we imagine that there's a whole dark sector that has some variety of particles, perhaps, just like the sector we live in has a variety of particles. And they have a variety of forces that interact. And so they can exchange virtual force particles, just like we exchange photons to transmit a force. And so that's self-interacting dark matter. So in this case, there's not just a dark sector that has the particle, like supersymmetry, but there are also entirely new forces of nature that are operating only in that dark sector. And so you can have a variety of electromagnetism that's mediated by dark photons. Told you light dark matter was not the worst name we would have. We also have dark photons. That's just the force that's operating in the dark sector to so that these particles can interact with each other. Does that sound plausible to you? We've invented a lot of new physics here. And the only evidence that we have new physics is astronomical observation. Now, I have become increasingly aware that there's sort of a shotgun marriage between astronomy and particle physics, and each take from the other what they want and ignore the rest. So when particle physicists hear that astronomers need dark matter, they're like, right, we'll give you a particle. And they don't really know that much about the astronomical evidence, which is one of the reasons I developed this course, was to try to give you a somewhat more nuanced understanding of the evidence that isn't just, oh, we need dark matter, and it could just be absolutely anything. That's not really true. Okay, so as we discussed last time, the big motivations for cold dark matter is that there seems to be more mass density out there in the universe. You try to weigh the gravity of the stuff out there. It's more than what you can explain with the density of normal matter, according to Big Bang nucleosynthesis in the early universe, by a factor of 5 or 6, which doesn't sound like a huge factor, and there are people who wring their hands over whether or not that's some sort of weird fine-tuning issue, because why not 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times more dark matter? But that's the number, and it is big enough to be significant. And then there's the need to grow cosmic structures. Baryons by themselves won't get you to the rich amount of structure we see in the universe today, where there are galaxies with lots of empty space between them, starting from the initial conditions of microwave background at a redshift around 1,000, which is very smooth and uniform. It's the same everywhere. So you have to go from that incredibly smooth initial condition to this really lumpy, very structured current. And cold dark matter will do that for you. And this is often argued as a reason as to why we absolutely have to have a new form of particle. However, both of these things assume that we know everything we need to know about gravity. That is, the growth of structure follows from perturbation theory and general relativity. If you make the force law stronger somehow, then maybe it'll grow faster. Same thing for point one. If the force law is stronger, then it's going to look like it weighs more, even if it doesn't. So that is a big assumption underlying that, and a very reasonable one, right? Just assuming that Einstein told us everything we need to know. And so that's the basis of a lot of this. As reasonable as that is, there are entire communities of scientists who try to figure out what is going on beyond Einstein, right? Einstein's theory of general relativity is classical. It's not a quantum theory, and so for those people, the baseline assumption is that Einstein did not teach us everything we had to know. And you say, well, then how does this affect that problem? Well, that's on big scales, and we're talking about quantum things on small scales. Like, okay, 1/1 is a big number, so there is a lot we don't know. This is all new physics, right? If you modify gravity or if you invent a completely new dark sector, it's entirely unknown physics. It doesn't fit into anything that we know already. That's why there's a lot of interest in it, but it's also a completely uncharted territory, and we know a lot less than we think we know, including that we don't really know that that assumption, as reasonable as it is, necessarily holds. So when we say the dark matter problem, really it could be literal invisible mass, the dark matter, or it could just be that we've inferred that because we're using the wrong equations. Now, you can exclude a lot of flavors of modified gravity theories. Our brains think on a size scale, so the first thing that we typically think of is, okay, maybe the force law changes on some large scale. We know the inverse square law works extremely well in the solar system. We know general relativity works well for pulsars and basically things that are solar system scale. But galaxies is where you see the need for dark matter. They're, you know, 1,000,000 times bigger than the solar system. So maybe there's some intermediate scale, a kiloparsec or something, where you get a transition to another force law. Now the signature of that would be that you always inferred the need for dark matter at that scale. Right? If you looked at smaller scales, then everything would be normal and behave like the solar system and just be Newtonian. But then as you looked at systems that were bigger than that, you would infer the need for dark matter, because really the force law has changed across this scale. So you'd always notice that need for dark matter at the same scale.
So here is an effort to quantify this. I made a long time ago. So this is the radius where the amount of dynamically required mass exceeds the luminous mass by a factor of 2. So the math is easy. So that's the dynamical mass. You measure B, you measure the radius, infer the total dynamical mass. And then the luminous mass is just some mass to light ratio, which you can guess from stellar population models. And a ballpark number is 1. The sun is fairly typical. And so 1 solar mass per solar luminosity would be within a factor of 2 usually of that. So you measure how much light, you infer the stellar mass, and then that radius is where so you clearly need something extra at that point. And there are lots of other ways you could do this, and we'll talk about them, but that's just what I happen to do here. Do you see a single scale? Is R to the 1 always the same? No. There are big galaxies, bright ones here, bright absolute magnitudes, where you don't really need dark matter until you get way far out, tens of kiloparsecs. Up until that point, basically, the stars suffice to explain what's going on. But then there are some fainter galaxies which already need dark matter at, a couple of kiloparsecs, much smaller scale. So you can generically exclude length scale-based modifications. Somebody comes and tells you, I have a new theory of gravity, and I change the force law, and whatever, 10 kiloparsecs or something. That does not work. Weirdly, there is a characteristic scale, and it's not a length scale, it's an acceleration scale. So this is what we observe for the centripetal acceleration in objects, so what it takes to keep a particle on a circular orbit, v squared over r, plotted against what Newton says that gravitational force should be, and those things are equal in the solar system. Right, basically, what you see for the force, radial force directed towards the sun, is equal to what Newton predicts there. That's why we have Newtonian gravity. The places where we infer dark matter are at this very small acceleration scale of about 1 part in 10 to the 10 meters per second per second. That scale's just in the data. When you're at much higher accelerations, you just don't see the need for dark matter. And then as you go to lower accelerations, you do need dark matter. That is, there's more force and Newton predicts for what you see. So that difference there is what we attribute to dark matter. But that there is a scale says, well, maybe the modification happens at an acceleration scale, not at not dark matter at all. So there is one theory that hypothesized that. There are lots of other theories that you can easily exclude. Other theories have been written to try to mimic the successes of these. This one, because it's the one that seems to work, mostly, not entirely, and it's not a complete theory. So this idea of Mond that Milgram hypothesized as an alternative to dark matter is a modification at the length scale. So above that acceleration scale, everything is Newtonian, and below it, the force law changes in a way that he wrote down in the formula. It's very weird. Basically, the hypothesis was that what you see is what you get, where G bar is basically Gm over R squared, right, for a point mass, and G obs for a circular orbit is V squared over R. There are more complex forms for non-circular orbits, but that's what it boils down to. And he says that's true as long as G is much greater than this new scale A naught. And that's just something that's in the data. Yes, the data. Where this happens is at 10 to the minus 10 meters per second per second. Remember, sitting in this room, you feel a force towards the center of the Earth of 9.8 meters per second per second. So this is 1 part in 10 to the 11th of what we feel here. It's completely outside our laboratory experience. The only place we see it is in extragalactic systems, the universe as a whole. So the hypothesis is that everything is normal at high accelerations, but at low accelerations, the effective acceleration is what Newton would say times this new constant in quadrature. Really messed up thing to do, theoretically, and yet that's what the data look like. So when the accelerations are much lower than A naught, that's what you get. And that's what that slope is here. Basically, this is a one-to-one relation. Here the slope is a half on a log-log plot. That's that square root. So Newton predicts something lower and lower and lower. And at some point, you get this boost from this weird product. And then we like to think of an interpolation function that joins the two regions smoothly. That's not fundamental to the theory. Just those two limits are that high acceleration, you get Newton, at low acceleration, you get this modified regime. Really weird theory, perhaps the weirdest of all that I've seen written down. And yet it's had a lot of predictions come true, and we'll talk about all that evidence. But I've always been taught that you are supposed to give a theory credit if it has predictions come true, even if you don't like the theory. Sort of part of the scientific method. Now, Mond is a modification of Newton. It is not a modification of general relativity. So it is by itself not a complete answer. There, if it is the right direction to think, and that's not obvious, but if it is, then one would like to believe that there is some deeper theory that connects both Mond and general relativity. Just as Newton was a subset of general relativity, then both general relativity and Mond would be a subset of this greater theory. Whatever it is, we don't know what it is. People have tried to build such theories, had mixed success. That's not something you do overnight, right? Oh, I'm going to modify Einstein. We'll just do it on the back of this napkin. It doesn't work that way. It takes a long time to sort these things out. For example, y'all recognize that equation? What's his name? That's the Poisson equation, right? This relates the gravitational potential to the distribution of mass that is its source, right? And then the actual force, the acceleration is, right? So if you can measure the distribution of mass, you can work out what the gravitational potential is and predict what the force is, and that's where that G bar came from up on the x-axis on this plot here. Solving that equation in most cases numerically, because real mass distributions are messy, analytic. It's not called the Newton equation. Right? This is an encapsulation of Newtonian physics. Newton wrote this many hundreds of pages of volumes in the Principia, all sorts of proofs in math. That didn't get there. He didn't get that far. It took decades and other people thinking about it to do this. So if there is some other theory, if not, it's something that's going to fall out. And it's, it would be really naive of us to expect this to be solved on a time scale of years or even decades. Of course, first you have to work on it, which as a community, we're not really there yet. Okay, so here's another way of showing that discrepancy is a function of acceleration. So this is the actual observed acceleration, doesn't matter which it is here. And this is the discrepancy, that is how much dark matter you need in each system. So in some sense, it's a measure of how much you've departed from the Newtonian line. And you notice that systematic, as you go to lower and lower accelerations, you infer more and more dark matter. Or that is, the modified force has become relatively stronger because of that weird quadrature thing, then the actual Newtonian prediction becomes less important. And so I do it this way to show a larger dynamic range. You see up through the solar system, which was all that was on this other plot, but we know of higher acceleration systems, like the surface of the Earth is higher acceleration than the orbits of the planets. There is a famous binary pulsar. This was awarded a Nobel Prize for showing indirect evidence for gravitational waves. This is before LIGO detected them directly. People observed that the orbit of this binary pulsar was decaying. It was losing energy. And that the decay rate was precisely what general relativity predicted for how much gravitational waves would be carrying away from that system. So relativity matters a lot there. Gravitational waves were inferred to exist because they were carrying energy away. We didn't observe them directly yet, but we could see what we expected. And so at its closest point, this pulsar system is on a very eccentric orbit. And so at periastron, when they're closer to each other, the acceleration is a couple hundred meters per square meter. 20 G, something like that. That wouldn't be comfortable. Okay, there are lots of other things, extreme systems. So when LIGO did come on, the first black hole merger it detected was this one, gravitational wave source, blah, blah, blah. And as black holes merge, they're emitting a lot of gravitational radiation. A lot of energy is leaving the system. I think in this case, it emitted the equivalent of three solar masses of rest mass energy, mc squared, in the form of gravity waves. That's a lot of energy. In those last few things, right, as they merged. But, you know, you can see what the orbits are going. You can measure the frequencies. You know what the masses are. So you can ask, what's that acceleration? Well, it's this ridiculous number, 10 to the 11 meters per second. Inconceivably high acceleration. But it's exactly what we expect from general relativity. So one of the attitudes people often has, well, you can't modify gravity because general relativity is so good. And that's true. It's really well tested at high accelerations. That has nothing to do with what's going on at low accelerations. The highest acceleration I've seen people discuss is basically the surface gravity of a neutron star that's on the cusp of collapse to a black hole. Basically, c squared over the Schwarzschild radius, right, just before you get to that point. That's pretty much the highest acceleration you can imagine. And that's around 10 to the 13 meters per second per second. Very uncomfortable, that, but not for me. So all these systems behave exactly as expected in Newton and Einstein. You definitely need Einstein from here on up. You don't need it on the surface of the Earth, except for very subtle corrections if you're doing global positioning or something like that. But it's really a tiny effect. Here is a dominant effect. But the dark matter problem that we're worried about appears down here. And the one system that deviates from this nice clean curve here are clusters of galaxies where they still, the discrepancy appears around the same acceleration scale, but it's not exactly the same. They're not exactly on top of the points from the galaxies, so maybe it's a coincidence. Maybe there's something goofy in the data.
Okay, so when I was your age, there was cold dark matter, which we knew was a WIMP. That was it. People talked about MACHOs, maybe it was brown dwarfs, but that was obviously stupid because of Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Right? You couldn't make enough brown dwarfs to have it be the dark matter without violating Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And actually, one of the experiences I had as I started to question some of these things was that some famous dynamicists would come up to me, and these are people whose names you would or will know, and they very quietly at conferences say, maybe the dark matter is baryonic. Because they didn't want to hear, let the cosmologists overhear them say that, because they knew it was non-baryonic because of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which is what I believed at the time, but apparently they trusted me to have a sympathetic ear, which was true. So there's always this tension between people who work on the dynamics of galaxies and see a lot of connections to the distribution of baryons and led many of them to infer that the dark matter was baryonic. And separately, an entire different community of people who mostly worried about cosmology, for which Big Bang nucleosynthesis was a great success, and so the fact that the mass density seemed to be bigger than that was just absolutely had to be non-baryonic, and the odds on favorite was always the WIMP, because of the WIMP variable. Those were basically the options you had when I was young. Now there's all this shit. Right? It's crazy. So we haven't solved this problem, and that has just made it worse. It's been an exciting place for theorists to go wild. It's wilding out here. This is a much more complicated diagram than I would like, but I'm trying to depict the relative virtues of different types of theories and also the observations that inform them. And the answer that you get out depends on which observations you care about, the weight that you put on them. And there is inevitably human judgment in making that choice and weighting. Statistics will not do it for you. Grok will not do it for you. It might put it in a bikini for you, but it won't give you the answer. And I mention that because right now I am getting like a dozen emails a day from people who've been talking to some AI bot and say, I've given you a new theory of everything. I can't read all that, let alone attempt to judge whether it makes any sense or not. Okay, gotta use your brain. So in the middle here is the astronomical evidence. And so on the top side are basically cosmology-related things. The two things I've emphasized so far, that the mass density is greater than the baryon density, and the fact that you need to grow structure from a very smooth microwave background to a lumpy scale today. So those were the inputs that gave us non-baryonic dark matter. And nowadays, there's also the detailed power spectrum, both of the distribution of galaxies in the local universe and the acoustic power spectrum of the microwave background, the angular power spectrum on the sky. How many lumps of what temperature? Just a Fourier transform of that. So if you don't know what any of those words mean, don't worry, we'll go through that. And that's often pointed as the best evidence that it has to be dark matter, in particular lambda CDM. And it is true that these things are very well fit by lambda CDM. It's also true that we have enough fit parameters that we were going to get a good fit. So that by itself I don't personally find persuasive, though it is an excellent fit. What I do find persuasive is that these fits give you an answer that is pretty much consistent with traditional astronomical approaches to cosmology, like the Hubble constant.
know, there was perfect agreement between the CMB and the Hubble constant measurements until there wasn't. So when WMAP was published 20 years ago, it found H naught of 72, which was the best measured traditional measure of the Hubble constant at the time. And that's where everybody decided, okay, we're right, it has to be lambda CDM. Of course, nowadays we have this tension between the traditional methods which give H naught of 73 now is the best number in terms of formal uncertainty. Whereas the fit to the power spectrum observed by Planck gives you 67. And those numbers are formally different than Phi Sigma. So, but they agreed before they didn't agree. And that is a good argument. It's not just the fit, it's also there's a whole bunch of data that are consistent with that. On cosmological scales, so that's sort of generically cosmology feeding into this. On the dynamic side, which is where we'll start out, because I take the traditional astronomy approach of starting at low redshift and working out, which is what we will do next semester if you take cosmology with me, as opposed to the physics approach where you start at t equals zero and work forward in time. But anyway, you have the dynamics of individual galaxies, that rotation curves are flat, and it gives you the need for dark matter clusters of galaxies, as we talked about before. The velocity dispersions are very high, the dark matter. Then there are a set of empirical laws that we'll discuss, like the baryonic Tully-Fisher relation, like this, which I call the radial acceleration relation, the relation between the acceleration you measure and what you predict. And those were predicted a priori by Mollin. Not just fit, but when Milgram first wrote down this formula, he said, okay, if that's true, these things have to follow. And those predictions came true. So, you know, that's a good argument on this side. This is a good argument on that side. So all these things feed into what I'm calling here the acceleration discrepancy. Most people would call that the dark matter problem. This term of the acceleration discrepancy I use because the discrepancy appears around an acceleration scale. And that's what Jacob Bekenstein suggested the terminology should be, which of course didn't stick on. Bekenstein was a relativist, and he spent a lot of time trying to build a theory, so now there are theories on either side, that included both general relativity and Mond. And so he built Aqual, which is an aquadratic Lagrangian theory, still only Newtonian, but it conserved energy. Just writing this down, one of the reasons it's weird, this doesn't conserve energy. Well, screw that, right? That's terrible. But what Bekenstein showed with this aquadratic Lagrangian theory was that you could modify the Poisson equation in such a way as to give you this force law while also conserving energy and momentum and things like that. So he tried to make a relativistic version of that, a rough ball, which did the dynamics right, but it did gravitational lensing wrong. So he spent a lot of time trying to figure out how that could be, eventually invented Tevis. But anyway, he's contributed a lot to that literature. But he's also done things, he was the one who came up with the thermodynamic description of black holes, holographic principle, things that people accept now without question. It's funny how this works sociologically because Bekenstein, and I've only read accounts of this before my time, and not really my field, but there was a conference where Bekenstein presented the thermodynamic interpretation of black holes and saying that the surface area of black hole is proportional to its entropy. At the same conference, there was this person you might have heard of, Stephen Hawking, who basically said the same thing, along with a few collaborators.
But he said it was a coincidence, whereas Bekenstein argued that no, it can't be a coincidence. The equations look the same, so that has to be telling us something. And basically, Hawking and his collaborators were like, ha ha, you're an idiot. Because if, and I'm retelling this based on the telling of one of the collaborators. Of course, he didn't say he was acting like a bully, but that was what he was describing himself as being. Because what they were saying is if the analogy was literal, then something, then a black hole would have to radiate. How would that be possible? No, it's not by definition. And so they were pretty nasty towards Bekenstein. But it got Hawking to thinking, and he thought about the quantum effects near to the surface of a black hole, and that's how he came up with Hawking radiation. So black holes do radiate. Requires quantum mechanics to do it. But Bekenstein got there first. He just got a lot of abuse for it. So, you know, one should take some, there's some crazy crackpot stuff that AI turns out every day, and it deserves none of your time, but it's hard to know. Hard to know when that is, because there are a lot of stuff that you think is crazy, it turns out not to. All you can do is learn to judge with your brain. There are lots of different theories now, some of which are already ruled out. There are lots of different kinds of flavors of dark matter that are done. There are sort of standard model particles here, which are mostly ruled out. Various kinds of dark matter particles, which are now proliferating, so I didn't attempt to put them all down there, but basically they all have some kind of new mass in a particle in some new dark sector, which may or may not have forces as well as massive particles. And you can also have hybrid models that do some sort of mix. So like the superfluid dark matter Justin Curry has talked about, it is a dark matter particle. But it has properties that it forms a Bose-Einstein condensate in the cores of galaxies, and that happens to give you Mach-like force law behavior. So it kind of tries to do the best of both things. But really, the right answer is probably not up there yet. All we know is that we don't know. All right. So this has been an intractable problem, and it's nearly a century old. As we talked about last time, this goes back to Oort and Zwicky in the 30s, maybe even before, but certainly then. And it was just too weird and wild, and people ignored it for half a century. But then it was picked up again in the late 60s and into the 70s, and it really took off at that time. And so it's been with us in a serious way for half a century. And people have been actively looking for dark matter at that time. The first WIMP experiments looking to do direct detection were in the 80s, and they've just been ramping up ever since, to the point where they literally want to have the entire globe supply of xenon to do this one experiment. They already have a large fraction. But we'll talk about why that's a desirable thing and how you go about doing it. But despite these decades of experimental searches, there's been no clear detection. There have, of course, been claims from time to time. DAMA was an experiment that claimed to do it, and nobody else could reproduce the results, so nobody believed it. It's just a really thorny problem. But what I want to emphasize here is that the need for something, be it dark matter or modified gravity or whatever you want to think of it as, that's really well established. There's a clear discrepancy between what you see and what you get. The dynamics of extra black system, the behavior of the entire cosmology. You can't just have normal gravity and the matter that we know about. You need something extra. But what that is, we don't really know yet. Okay. So, have you ever had a philosophy of science course?
Yeah.
Good. Because I find a lot of scientists don't. So
actually have a very toy idea of what it is that they're doing. And so at one point I made up this as my idea of what was going on, and even this is a gross oversimplification, but it fits on one slide. And on the one side, we have sort of observed reality, that's what we're trying to explain, with our theoretical interpretation on the other side. So we start with some sort of natural phenomena, sun rises in the east, and we build a hypothesized explanation for that. Well, the sky is spinning around above us, carries the sun over our heads every day. And you use those hypotheses to make predictions, and the important thing you have to do here are twofold. One, you have to explain the phenomena you already know about. Right? A hypothesis is no good if it blatantly violates something like the conservation of energy. But you also want to make new hypotheses, predict new phenomena that have not yet been observed, and that's sort of the golden test, if you can go and find that. So you make some predictions for, hey, if it works this way, then some such and such should follow. So, you know, for example, if Galileo comes along and says, well, maybe it's not the sky spinning over our head, maybe it's the earth turning under our feet. What's different about that? Not a lot. Both of those will explain the rising and setting motions of the sun and the stars. But there are some subtle things, and in retrospect, I think the best evidence that Galileo obtained with his little telescope was the phases of Venus. As you could obviously see that the phase of Venus correlated with where it was relative to the sun, so it was gibbous when it was on the far side of the sun, and its angular size was bigger, but it was crescent when it was on the near side of the sun. Whereas in the geocentric hypothesis, with the Earth at the center, Venus is always between us and the sun. It never gets to the far side, so you should never see a gibbous Venus. So at the time, that was absolutely nail in the coffin of the geocentric model. It took decades and decades to appreciate that. At the time, it was just seen as another piece of evidence. Argue either. So it takes a while for us to wrap our heads around these things. Another example of how long it takes to wrap your head around these things is given by correspondence that Newton had with Bentley. So Newton came up with the inverse square law in 1664, 1684, so 20 years later. Bentley wrote him and asked, well, geez, if all the stars have this 1/n² square law attraction, will everything just fall to a point? And Newton was like, I hadn't thought of that. 20 years, one of the most brilliant minds in human history, hadn't thought of that obvious point. We think of it's obvious now. It wasn't then, right? It takes a while to do that. And so Newton came up with a really lame excuse. He said, well, everything is equidistant, so on average, everything is pulled away. And Bentley basically wrote back, and it was very polite and very formal, and lots of words that say, really? Because and Newton thought about it and said, you're right. It's like if you would try to stand the heads of pins up all around, as soon as one of them tips over, then it's not symmetric anymore, and you have the same problem. And so the solution they eventually arrived at, God fixes it. God actively intervenes to not a scientific explanation, right? So, you know, it was also around that time, probably inspired by that conversation, that Newton first realized that the inverse square law wasn't just some mathematical happenstance. It happened for a very good geometric reason. Right? If you're a point source, you throw a bunch of force rays out there, you can just imagine standing there throwing a bunch of beams or something, then they're going to get fewer and fewer as you go far away. That's just because there's more and more space for them to throw in. Inverse square law is just geometry. We expect our first year physics students to understand that right away. Why don't you get that, you idiot? It took Newton 20 years. All right. So it takes a while for us to wrap our heads around this. Okay, so as a theorist, we make predictions, and then as an experimentalist, we say, okay, we'll test this theory. And of course, this is tied into the natural phenomena that we already knew, and this is going to be some novel kind of formula. And we now, at this point, know a lot of things, so it's hard to find new tests. But we are talking about new physics in a new regime, very low acceleration. And so there are several outcomes that can happen from an experimental test, and one is that the experiment isn't really good enough to distinguish the new prediction from whatever you already believed. And so you go back and improve your experiment. This is the loop that most observers and experimentalists spend their entire careers in. Right? Most of your time is spent improving the experiment, doing it better, making it better, trying to get that better result. Now, once in a while, you get good enough to say, no, that prediction was wrong. I have the error bar small enough now to say that prediction was wrong, so it's excluded. And so you can reject that hypothesis. That's formally what we do. Of course, the other thing is then you have to go back and build some completely new hypothesis all over. Or maybe you say, well, that's what I predicted, but really, it's just a little different. So the basic idea is right, the hypothesis was right, I just have to tweak it some. And so then you just go back and re-examine the prediction, not really changing the hypothesis, just tweaking it. And that's the loop that most theorists spend most of their career in. It's very rare that you actually reject a theory entirely and go back to square one, or at least the square run of that particular theory. And you will find that theorists are very reluctant to do that. Once they have an idea they like, they tend to stick to it no matter what the evidence says. So theorists are doing this loop and experimentalists are doing that loop. An even rarer outcome is you do an experiment for some novel prediction of a hypothesis and confirm it. Right? So an historical example of that is Einstein's prediction of light bending from gravitational lensing. It's not like that was something that was not already predicted by Newton, but in JR, the amplitude of that bending is twice what it was in Newton around the sun. And Eddington famously went out and did that in Eclipse in 1919 and claimed to confirm the prediction. If you go back and look at his data, they sucked. So I'm not sure he could really make that claim, but he did. And that led to general relativity being accepted because it had made this novel prediction. The observer went out and tested it, and it was confirmed. Hooray. So that's even more rare when that happens. In principle, it can never happen. There's this important principle of doubt that I literally listed from an Astro 101 textbook, and it seems to come as a surprise to a lot of practicing scientists, because their ability in these little loops, I shouldn't have done that. They're stuck in whatever loop they're in, and they never go back to the basics. But the scientific method basically says, in trying to construct a theoretical representation of reality, and the best you can really hope to do is obtain an approximation to reality that works up within some finite bounds. Never found a theory of everything. And you can't expect Darwinian evolution to explain why the moon orbits at the speed it does. But it's a different question, right? So theories have their limits. And you can do this hypothesis testing and you can confirm the prediction, but that doesn't really mean it has to be that way. So that's usually how we interpret it. It's just that we haven't yet rejected it. So you're always doubting. It's something that can be rejected for sure, but never entirely confirmed. That's in principle. In practice, that's not how we behave at all, right? Newtonian gravity is right. It is, right? It's been proven a zillion times, and so we tricked it. But there can be tweaks to it, of which general relativity was one. So there can be more general things. So if that's a theory can be adequate for describing a specific set of phenomena, of course, then you have to worry about what do we mean by adequate? What is a satisfactory theory? Preferably not something that's too much of a Rube Goldberg machine. You should not trust the theorist. You have to verify what they say through experiment. Right now, we live in an age where people trust simulations, and in spite of this, cosmological simulations never once have we gotten a lot of things right. So, and then there's this. This is a statement of value that simple theories are preferable to complicated theories, like Occam's razor. A simple explanation is preferable to a complicated Rube Goldberg machine. And the reason for that is if you have a Rube Goldberg machine with all these different moving parts and parameters, and you can arrange it to explain pretty much anything. And that's one of my objections to cosmological simulations, that they basically become that kind of Rube Goldberg machine. So if it's complicated enough, you can tweak the parameters to explain anything, and so it's no longer useful as a predictive tool. The essential element of science is that you can predict behavior ahead of time. Right? Newton's theory allows you to predict where a satellite is going to go if you launch it in a certain direction at a certain speed. And we've been able to do that and send satellites to other planets and all over the solar system with precision like yay big, over millions and millions of miles. So Newton works really well as a predictive power. You cannot do that with a cosmological simulation. You may simulate a universe that looks entirely like the real universe, but you can never go into that and say, okay, this galaxy is that real galaxy out there in space. And you can't use that to predict anything about that. So you have to be aware of what the limits of these are. Simulations can be a useful tool for eliminating how certain processes work in sort of a statistical sense, but they're never predictive, which is the essence of this. And so any theory, you'll sometimes hear people complain about, oh, that theory is epicyclic. And usually that term is used to mean that, like actual epicycle theory, that it's very complicated, that there are lots of moving parts, and so you can arrange it to fit in. Another thing that I learned somewhere, which seems to have disappeared as a value system, and this is another statement of value, is that if a theory has its predictions come true, then we're obliged to acknowledge its efficacy, even if we hate the theory. Right? This is an element that's what's supposed to make science objective. Try to pretend like science is objective, but in my experience, the people who are scientists, who even good scientists, are very rarely good at being objective. They have theories they like, they have theories they hate, and they behave accordingly. And it's these predictions, that's methods of hypothesis testing, that's supposed to keep us honest. So that's an important thing of that. Because you don't like a theory, doesn't matter. What matters if it has its predictions come true. And of course, you have to be able to determine the difference between one hypothesis and another. So measurement uncertainty is very important. No experiment is perfect. There's always some error. You know, we're always working, you know, people talk to each other so they know what theories are on and what are not allowed anymore. We're always working at that edge of the experimental limits. So we live in that experimental loop of always improving our experiments, because that's often the difference between rejecting a hypothesis or confirming it, or simply continuing to get ambiguous results. That is, the theorists are good at what they do, so they've already explained everything we already know. You have to look for the differences beyond that. It's not always in the sixth place of decimals. Some of the fields it is, but not in astronomy. So you have to not just measure something like the Hubble constant, but also how accurate it is. Is it 73 plus or minus 10?
Well, that's consistent with pretty much everything you want to talk about. 73 plus or minus 1, that is not consistent with the 67 plus or minus a half that Planck claims.
So that uncertainty is really important. It's really hard to do this in astronomy. You can make an estimate of your four normal errors. There are many errors that you can control and measure accurately, but there's always something that's uncontrolled. Astronomy is a passive science. You're observing the universe, usually with photons, and those photons come from sources that are bright. Right? They're not coming from sources that are dark. There's already a selection effect built into that. But more importantly, we are not an experimental science that can put an experiment on a desktop and control all the conditions in which it operates. The universe is an uncontrolled experiment. We do not set its bounds. So there are often and almost always systematic uncertainties that are not so easy to quantify that you want to do so. One of which, I've erased it, but one of which is the stellar mass to light ratio. Right, I told you that m to l of 1 in solar units is a good ballpark number, and that is true. But for any galaxy, it has some complex stellar population that has all sorts of different stars in it, and whether that averages out to 1.2 or 0.8 or 3.7, there are ways of estimating that, but it's hard. And it has some systematics in doing that. So even if you explain spectral energy distribution of a galaxy just so you have the right mix of stars to give the right colors and every wavelength, et cetera, you still have to know what the mass function of the stars is, because most of the light comes from high mass stars, A stars, B stars, O stars. They're very bright, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of solar luminosities. So their m to l is almost zero. Very little mass goes a long way in producing light. So they produce all the light. If you integrate up the mass function, most of the mass is in sort of half solar mass stars, which are incredibly dim. They're like a thousandth of a solar luminosity. So what you're measuring is the light from these bright stars, and what you want to know is the mass in those little stars. Now, locally, we've measured that reasonably well. It's hard, but I think we have a pretty good handle on it at this point. We have to assume that applies everywhere in the universe in order to estimate that mass to light ratio. That seems to work, but it's a huge systematic, right? If other galaxies, for whatever reason, produce a lot more M dwarfs than ours does, then it's going to have a higher mass to light ratio because there's a lot of mass locked up in low mass stars that are not shining as bright as the other ones. And there are ways to constrain that, but there's always something like that in astronomy, and it's often bigger than your formal uncertainties. All right, so if we had time, I should have brought this up already. Let's see if I can find it. So this is an illustration of epicycles on YouTube. All right, so we complained about how complicated theories can get. So this is an example with epicycles. So there's one big orbit, and then there's an orbit at the end of that, and then an orbit on top of that, and an orbit, right, a whole bunch of epicycles. Right. Now the actual theory of Ptolemy was more sophisticated than that. It has epicycles and deference, so that the center didn't have to be the center, it could be offset. So this is sort of mean. Ptolemy's theory was way better than this. But it illustrates what one means, when if you make a theory too complicated, you can get it to do anything you want. So now it's gone around one complete orbit, now it's tracing out the path of the particle, right? So the particle is moving around the little epicycle, it's moving around the other epicycle, it's moving around the other epicycle, and so forth and so on. And somebody went to the bother to work out what it would take to trace this out. I don't know why you would do that, but it's a useful illustration. Two-body problem in the solar system, it'll keep going to the same place over and over again. So if you make something that's complicated enough, you can explain anything. So that is why we have that as a value system in science. We prefer easy things, simple things that don't do that. Where's my cursor? There it is. All right. That's probably a good place to end. We're a few minutes early, but we will talk about Zwicky's problem next time, things like clusters of galaxies and measuring those velocity dispersions. So we'll get past the philosophy and into the actual nitty-gritty of what the missing mass problem is. So go out, build a snowman or something, or stay in and keep warm, whatever you like.
You're not having trouble with suspicious.